Good morning to everyone. Welcome to the ETM Broadcasting Network. I'm speaking to you from beautiful Charleston, South Carolina. And I want to wish a special welcome to Rabbi Achiya Deluya, who's joining us this morning the first time. He's the headmaster of the Addlestone Hebrew Academy in Charleston. And I had the pleasure of spending Friday in his school and Shabbat in his community with us this morning. My friends, we started last week the study, the 10th Perek of Pesachim, Perek Arvei Pesachim, sorting, as you have on your source sheets, and we saw that there are quite instances, both in the beginning of the Perek, the Tosefta from the beginning of the Perek, and two or three Baraitot that all deal with the same subject, which is the argument between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda from the generation of Usha in Eretz Israel about when can one not eat Erev Pesach, Erev Shabbat, and Erev Chag. We saw that the Mishnah is a Mishnah, is a Sam Mishnah. We have the statement in the Mishnah, Arvei Pesachim Samuch L'Mincha Lo Yuchal Adam Ad Shetechshach. We don't know according to which Tannaitic opinion this statement is. Rebbe brings it as a Stam Mishnah. But as soon as we open up the Tosefta, we see the same position as stated again. Erev Pesachim Samuch L'Mincha Lo Yuchal Adam Ad Shetechshach. But the minute we open the Braitot from the Bavli, we saw that it's not presented as a Stam Mishnah, but rather as a Machloket. Lo Yuchal Adam Be'arvei Shabbatot Be'amin Tovim Min Amincha Ulamala Kedei Shnikanet L'Shabbat Shuta Aved Divrei Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Yossi Omer Ochel V'Holech Ad Shetechshach. We have a Machloket Tana'im from Dor Usha whether one may commence a meal from Mincha or Samuch LeMincha until it gets dark on Erev Chag. And this raises the question about our Mishnah, which is brought as a Stam Mishnah. Is it a Stam Mishnah that Rebbe brought from his Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda, or from Rebbe Yossi? Is our Mishnah according to Rebbe Yehuda, or is it according to Rebbe Yossi? And we have another Braita, which says, brings down the same Machloket again. Lo yuchal adam ve'erev Shabbat ve'yamim tovim mitesha sha'ot ulamala kedei shnikanes l'Shabbat shutada divrei Rebbe Yehuda. Therefore, we have a doubt exactly what our mission is trying to say. Is it possibly like Rabbi Yehuda, or is it possibly like Rabbi Yossi? This we did last week. And then we took a look at the statements of the Amoraim, and we saw that in our Gemara, we have in our Sugya number one, which you have in front of you on the source sheets, we have basically two approaches. We have the approach of Rav Huna, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Sura in the second generation of the Babylonian Amoraim, where he says simply, L'Rabbi Yossi, that our Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Yossi. That even though Rabbi Yossi holds that on Arvei Shabbatot and Chagim, one can eat all the way up until dark, he agrees that on Erev Pesach, because of the special chiyuv of eating matzah, that one must not commence a meal from Samuch L'Mincha, that is 9 hours of temporal daylight, and on. But one may begin a meal before that. If one wants to begin a meal at 8 hours of daylight or 7 hours of daylight, Rabbi Yossi has no problem with that. One may not commence a meal from Samuch L'Mincha, which is 9 hours of temporal daylight, and on. This is presented by the Gemara first, Rav Huna. This is Torah Surah. And then we see that the next Amora that's mentioned is Rav Papa, who is a fifth generation Amora from Narash, three generations after Rav Huna. And also, Rav Papa is the Talmid of Rava from Achoza, and is therefore more of a local Babylonian tradition, as opposed to Rav Huna, who is the Talmid of Rav, Eretz Israel, the tradition. Anyway, Rav Papa wants to tell us that you can understand our Mishnah not only according to Rabbi Yossi, as Rav Huna says, but he says you can even understand it according to Rabbi Yehuda, because Rabbi Yehuda holds that on Arvei Shabbatot and Yamin Tovim, and other Yamin Tovim, that the prohibition is to begin a meal from mincha ulamala, that is mincha ktana, 9.5 hours of tikkun daylight or higher. Whereas on Erev Pesach, because of the special mitzvot achirah, that one has to abstain from beginning a meal any time from 9 hours of temporal daylight, samuch lemincha, even a half hour earlier. And that we have this therefore a machloket. We have the machloket Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda, and we have two different approaches to determining whether our in Rabbi Yosef Shita, that he holds Yisur by Erev Pesach, or whether we can understand the Chidush of our Mishnah according to Rabbi Yehuda, that the Yisur is Samuch L'mincha, and not just Mimincha, as we do in Shabbatot. Then we saw last week that the other Amoraim, that are later than Rav Papa, that they discuss Rav Papa Shita, because we have another Braita that seems to say that Rav Yehuda says that even the Erev Shabbat and Yamin Tovim, we have an Isur to eat from Teisha Sha'ot Ulamala, to begin a meal from Teisha Sha'ot Ulamala, from Samuch L'mincha. And therefore, this would imply that I have no need for our Mishnah to tell me that, because Rabbi Yud, there's no Chidush in our Mishnah. He holds Samuch L'mincha by Shabbat and Erev Chag as well. And this casts a doubt on Rav Papa's contribution to our Sugya above. So Marzutra, who was a generation after Rav Papa, he comes and he says, well, who says that this Braita is Mitaratza? Who says it's even correct? Maybe it's Mishaveshta, and therefore we can toss this Braita out and leave Rav Papa's position that we have a Chidush in our Mishnah according to Rav Yehuda, that even Samuch L'mincha would be forbidden. But Marimar, and some say it's Rav Yemar, say, no, you can't throw this Braita out. It is Mitaratza, because they give an Edut that they were at the shiur of Rav Pinchas Vreda Rav Ami, and a Tana, that is a human tape recorder that knew all the Mishnayot and all the Braitos, stood up and said this Braita, and Rav Pinchas Vreda Rav Ami accepted it. And if he accepted it, it means that Rav Yehuda holds Samuch L'mincha, even by Shabbat and Yom, and other Arvei Yomim Tovim, and therefore there is no Chidush whatsoever in our Mishnah, according to Rav Yehuda. And therefore, Rav Papa's statement cannot stand. This leaves us only with the statement of Rav Huna, who explained that the Chidush of our Mishnah is that while Rav Yosef holds on Shabbatot and Arvei Yomim Tovim, that one may begin a meal anytime one wants, up till dark, there is no restriction. By Erev Pesach, he agrees that there is a restriction that one may not begin a meal from Samuch L'mincha, and upon. This is where we left off last week, destroyed Rav Papa's approach, and we were left with Rav Huna. And then we note now, if we move on in the Sugya, that the Samadik Gemara, this is again, is not part of the Amorei context of the Sugya, but the Samadik Gemara then says, well, maybe Rav Huna's approach is also problematic. And in section 8, we find that the Samadik Gemara on your source sheets of the Sugya, brings a statement in the name of Rabbi Yirmiah, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. This is already an Eretz Israel de Gamora. Rabbi Yirmiah is a fourth generation Israeli Amora. He was a student of Rabbi Zera, who was a student of Rabbi Yochanan in Tveria. And he quotes Rabbi Yochanan, and some say that it's Rabbi Abau, who's quoting Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Kanina, that's saying that halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan. Like Rabbi Yossi on Erev Shabbat, meaning it would appear that we have an argument both on Erev Shabbat and on Erev Pesach, which means that Rabbi Yossi does not agree that on Erev Pesach one has to abstain from beginning a meal any time from 9 hours and above. He doesn't have that opinion. He argues on that as well. So therefore Rav Huna's suggestion that our Mishnah should be understood according to Rabbi Yossi would not stand. To this, the Gemara responds in 8 Bet Aleph that halacha miklal b'pligi b'hafsaka, that the argument between Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda on Erev Pesach does not have anything to do with whether one may begin a meal from 9 hours and above. Everyone agrees that that was not acceptable, and Rav Huna's statement that our Mishnah's Kiddush goes according to Rabbi Yosef is correct. But rather, we have a machloket between Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda about hafsaka, that if you begin a meal, the heter, before 9 hours on Erev Pesach, do you have to interrupt it from 9 hours on, or are you allowed to continue eating until dark if you began at the heter? And this is what we have in the next bright of this part in the sugya. Mafsikin l'shabbatot, divrei Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi Omer, en mafsikin, that there is a machloket between them, whether you have to be mafsi or not be mafsi, on Shabbatot in the mitzvah. And then we have the ma'aseh of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the nasi at the time of Usha, and Rabbi Yud and Rabbi Yosef, that are in Akko, and what happened, we looked at this braita last week, and we see that from this braita that there was a machloket, a rather fierce machloket actually, between Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yudah, whether it has to be mafsi, the su'udah, or not. Okay, now where do we stand after this, at the end of this sugyat? We have the only Amora left standing is Ravuna, who holds that our Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Yose, but we have Raita, upheld Rabbi Pinchas Baram. Okay, at this point, is everything clear, my friends, in this sugyat before we proceed to analyze further? If not, please speak up or submit something to the chat. Let's see, what is the question here? One question, yes. Yisrael, please ask your question. Yisrael is asking, what is the purpose of the black words within the red writing? So if everyone takes a look at the page, I'll explain how it's set up. As you all see on these source sheets, the blue letters represent the Tana'im, the statements of the Tana'im, either in the Mishnah or in Braitot. The red letters represent the Meirot of the Amoraim. And the black letters represent the Stama de Gemara, the additions of the Sugya after the close of the Amoraic discussion. Now, sometimes you can have black letters inside of a red statement, that is, that the Stama de Gemara has added something to the statement of the Amora. And sometimes you can have red letters inside of a black statement, that is, that the Stama de Gemara is quoting a Maimra. And so we always color the sources according to what they originally were, and that way preserve. Now let's go, I hope that answers your question, Mr. Now let's just go again and ask ourselves the following question. We see here that by the end of the Amoraic period, that is, in the sixth generation, when we have the statement of Rav Marimar, or Rav Gemar, about Rabbi Pinchas Barami, the end of the Amoraic, that Rav Huna's Shita is correct and Rav Papa's Shita is not, because we have a bright against Rav Papa. What is the role in this Sugya? The Stama de Gemara that contributes to our understanding of these earlier statements of the Tana'im and Amoraim. Let's go back to the very beginning of the Sugya and let's take a look at this. What exactly is that? Black letters. In line number one of the Sugya, you can see that the Stama de Gemara is adding a question. My Iriya Arve Tzachim, Afilu Arve Shabbatot, V'yamin Tovim, Name. What is the purpose of this Mishnah that says this din, this law, by Arve Tzachim? The same law applies by Arve Shabbatot and Yamin Tovim. Let's define this question more carefully. What exactly is the Gemara asking? The Gemara is saying that why does our Mishnah recite this din specifically regarding Erev Pesach? It should have been Shabbatot and Yamin Tovim in general, and not tied specifically to Erev Pesach. What do I learn from the fact that our Mishnah presented this din as a special din regarding Erev Pesach? And we have a question. And Eitan is asking, what does the word Iriya mean? Iriya means relevance of. My Iriya, how is it, what does it belong? How does it belong here? So what the Gemara is asking, how does this din belong only to Erev Pesach? It belongs to Arve Shabbatot and Yamin Tovim B'Klal. And so then comes the Braita. The Braita, however, was there before the Stama de Gemara. the Brayta comes and says that we have Machloket Rav Yudin Rav Yossi, whether one may begin a meal after 9 hours. And then Rav Huna is actually, as it were, seems to be responding to the Stamad Gemara, according to Rav Yose, who generally holds that it's Mutter, here he holds it's Asr. And this kind of a setup, we're used to this kind of a setup in the Gemara, that an Amora seems to be responding to the Stamad Gemara, but we know that the Amora is not responding to the Stama, because the Stama is later than the Amora. But rather, what happens, it comes and places itself here as in order to help us understand the context and the connection between the sources. The Stama de Gemara is the one who is speaking out the relationship between these sources and discussing their relevance. And similarly then, in the words of Rav himself, in 2 Aleph and in 2 Bet, we have a fleshing out of what Rav Huna himself said. Rav Huna said, the Rebbe Yosef, our Mishnah is according, but the Stama de Gemara is simply what Rav Huna meant. Lo tzricha ela, the Rav Yosef. I don't need this Mishnah, except according to the Shita of Rav Yosef, who holds generally, ochel v'holech ad shekashach, but that's regarding Arvei Shabbatot and Yamin Tovim. But on Erev Pesach, even Rav Yosef would agree. So what it would be, this is the first, let's say, function of Stama de Gemara that we have in the Gemara, which is that its purpose is simply to present and explain the Amoraim. And this is what it does. A later teacher who's teaching the earlier sources to his students is fleshing out the discussion by putting in these explanatory statements so that his students can understand what is the connection between the Tanaim and Amoraim. This is the simplest and most innocuous form of Stama de Gemara that we have. Something is happening in number 3. Rav Papa simply said, the Erev HaPesach afilu samuk l'mincha asur. That's all that he said. But the Stama de Gemara is, as it were, filling in by adding afilu tema ribi Yuda, that there by Arvei Shabbatot. But here he holds samuk l'mincha. So the role of the Stama de Gemara up to component number 3 is the first and most basic role of the Stama, which is to present and explain according to statements of the Tanaim and Amoraim. Then, however, in number 4, the Stama takes on a second role. And the second role of the Stama is not only to explain what has been said, but it's to hear deeply what has been said. So Yisrael is asking, is this Amoraim with Eluvim? Yes, that's correct. The sugya that we have up to number 3, and including kapuna number 3, is an actually up to 5 and 6 is really an amoraic sugya with a little bit of stama filler to explain it. How do I know that it's an amoraic sugya? I hope you all remember from our previous shiurim that I know that it's an amoraic sugya because the amoraim are mentioned in chronological sequence. Rav Huna is generation 2, Rav Papa is generation 5, and Marzutra and Marimar and Rav Yemar are in either late 5 or early 6. And therefore, since they are in chronological sequence, it is an Amoraic Sugya, and we learn the Amoraim before the Stama. Now, once we get to number, Nachum is asking, is the Stam Digmara the same as the Savoraim? Yes, it basically is. Stama de Gemara is almost always the Savoraim, although there are cases of Stama de Gemara that are slightly earlier, and there are cases of Gemara later. There are Stama de Gemara, and there is very late Amoraic Stama de Gemara. I say that's why I term Stama de anonymous Gemara, and I Savoraim, because I have no way to prove, one way or another, whether the Stama de Gemara is Amoraic, Savoraic, or early Gaonic. I have no way to prove that. But in any event, let's get back to our discussion of the functions of the Stama de Gemara. Up through and including component number 7, this is simply explaining the words of the Tanaim and the Amoraim. But in number 8, the Stama de Gemara now goes to a deeper level. It says, well, who says that Rav Huna is correct in what he says? the first part of the sugya now took it as a given, as a conclusion, that Rav Huna is presenting the correct approach, but our Mishnah goes according to Rabbi Yossi. Now the Stam is saying, who says, maybe we have a problem with that. And it comes from Eretz, which implies a machloket between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, also on Erev Pesach. And that would mean that Rav Huna is incorrect. Now, the material that's being quoted, the Israeli Amoraim, Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yossi Barakanina, is contemporaneous with Rav Huna. That means that it may represent a different approach in Eretz Israel to understanding the Mishnah to that which we have in Bavel, of Rav Huna. And the Gemara presents this question in order, in 8 bets, to knock it down and say, no, the purpose, this argument that is being brought down by Rabbi Yirmiah or by Rabbi Abaum has nothing to do with our sugya, but whether or not one can begin a meal after 9 hours of a temporal daylight on Erev Pesach. This statement is talking about a machloket, a second machloket between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, about whether one has to interrupt a meal if it's already been begun. And that is leads us to the final braita of the sugya, which is being brought by the Stam of Gemara to prove its point, and with that the sugya ends. So really, now we've learned about two different functions of the Stam of Gemara. The first is to present and interpret according to pshat, the statements of the Tanaim and Amoraim, and the second is to deepen the analysis of the Tanaim and Amoraim by challenging and by bringing other sources to measure whether the simple sugya is correct in what it says or whether it is not. And for our purpose, it has another function as well. The way the sugyas were edited together, this first sugya starts with the issue of whether one may begin a meal, hakalat sugya, and ends with the issue of hafsakat sugya, because the next sugya deals with hafsakat sugya, and therefore this part of the sugya is connecting one sugya to the other. You see, it's as if the editor, who saw the first sugya deals with hakalat sugya, machloket Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda, usually, but the Rabbi Yossi is agreeing with Rabbi Yehuda on Erev Pesach, and the second sugya is dealing with the issue of hafsaka, and therefore we have the second part of our first sugya, which is a bridge between the two sugyot altogether. Now let's take a look at the second sugya now and see what it says. Are there any questions on this first sugya before we go further? Please speak up.
Okay, question. So therefore, since this is the Amorayic with a Stama filler, what would people see before the Stama period, whoever that was? Maybe it's the Varayim, I'm not sure. Would they just see kind of the red part, and then people who came later filled in the black, and the students after the Stama would see it as we're seeing it?
Yes, fairly much. They would see before the period of the Stama, they would have learned by heart the Mishnah, the Braita, because all of those materials in Hebrew are meant to be learned by heart. And the later students would have the benefit of the Stama Digmara, who is the Sugya, who's explaining the earlier sources to them. Are there any other questions? Please feel free. Just press on your translation button. Eitan is asking, so the end of the first sugya is a bridge to the second one. If so, why break them into at the end of number one to number two? Or did I miss something? The mention of the Gemara into sugya, it's not Torah Misinai. And if you want to see the whole thing as one sugya, you can. I just feel that for didactic purposes, it makes sense to break it up into small. Eliyahu Gerstel from Toronto was saying, how do you use numbers in the Gemara? One Aleph, one Bet. Okay, the way we do it is as follows. Look at the page of Gemara. You'll see that we first number the main with 3 for primary numbering. Okay, does everyone see that on the pages of Gemara? 1, 2, 3, 4, the number that's that's all the way to the right. Then, within a primary number, we'll subdivide it into smaller pieces of discussion by saying 1 Aleph, 1 Bet, 1 Gimel, 2 Aleph, 2 Bet, 2 Gimel. That's the secondary numbering system. And then, if a secondary component needs to be further subdivided to make it add a tertiary number system, which is 1 Bet Aleph, 1 Bet 1, 1 Bet 2, etc. Like, I hope that's clear. Other questions, please? Okay, now, a very important question comes up in general. We've mentioned previously, but for the sake of those that have not been with us before, I want to briefly mention it again. And that is, does the Summa de Gomorrah bring to us traditions from the purity of the Amoraim about how to explain the earlier sources? Or is the Summa de Gomorrah an innovative, giving us its interpretation of the earlier sources, but not a tradition that was handed down? And if those of you that have learned with me in the past know that I don't take a dogmatic position on this topic, that sometimes it appears to me that the Summa de Gomorrah is presenting earlier material, and sometimes it's presenting its own, and both are completely legitimate, because it's all been accepted, after all, in Gomorrah by Klal Yisrael, and the Sefaraim, even if it is their innovative and creative students of the Amoraim. They're the teachers of the Gaonim. And the fact that we separate them into different historical layers is not in any way pejorative. It's simply historical for the sake of seeing the development of the sugya. Okay, move on now to sugya number two. Everyone please turn to sugya number two. And Daf Kuf Amud Aleph, for those of you using Goma. Our sugya immediately opens with a statement of an Amora. First, let's scan it and see what kind of sugya this is. Yisrael Kashkin for Fosaic is asking, when we say that Klal Yisrael accepted the Gomorrah, do we mean that it accepted the Gomorrah with the Stama? Yes, the Stama de Gomorrah is binding on us no less than the words of the Amoraim. Okay, let's look at sugya number two. Who do we have in sugya number two? Please respond, either by speaking or with your chat button. Which Amoraim do we have here? In sugya number? Yes, we have Rav Yehuda. Now be careful. It's not Rav Yehuda. It's Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda would be the Tana. Rav Yehuda is the Amora. He's a student of Shmuel. He's the Rosh Yeshiva in Kumbedita in the second generation. He's a friend of Rav Huna. Okay? So that's right. We have Rav Yehuda. We have Rav Taflifa, who's also saying in the name of Shmuel. So both Rav Taflifa Bar Avadimi and Rav Yehuda are second generation Amoraim, speaking in the name of Shmuel. And then we have Rabba Bar Rav Huna 3. And Rabba Bar Rav Huna, we know who Rav Huna is. We've met him in our previous sugya. He's a second-generation Babylonian Amora, and this is his son from the third generation. So therefore, according to what we see now in the sugya, what kind of a sugya do we have here in front of us? Is this an Amoraic sugya, or is this a Stama sugya, and how do you know? Please respond. Is this an Amoraic sugya or a Stama sugya? Jeff says it's a Stama sugya because the order of the Amoraim isn't chronological. You need to explain that to me, because Rav Yehuda and Rav Tachlifa are both second generation Amoraim speaking in the name of generation one, Shmuel. And then we have the third generation of Rabba Bar Rav Huna. What is not chronological here? Yes, now you're correct, that's right. So that, and Betsy notes, and Amorek Sugya goes in order. But can you repeat who they were, please? I was looking for the names when you said their generations. Sure. Rav Yehuda is a second generation Babylonian Amora. He's the Rosh Yeshiva in Kumbetita. And he's speaking in the name of his Rebbe, Shmuel, who was the head, was the Rosh Yeshiva of Nehardea in the first generation. Rav Tachlifa Bar Avadimi, who appears in component number two, is also a Babylonian second generation Amora. And Rava Bar Ravuna, who appears in son of Ravuna, who we learned about in the previous circuit. And Rava is Bar Ravuna is a third generation Babylonian Amora. And therefore we see that the Amoraim in the Sugya appear in chronological sequence. Now Eitan is asking, is the Resh Galuta mentioned by Rava Bar Ravuna referring to his father? No. Now Resh Galuta is not the same as Rosh Yeshiva. The Roshei Yeshiva were the heads of the Yeshivot in Sura, in Kumbadita, in Mechoza, in places like that. But Resh Galuta, there's only one. He is the head of the community of Jews in Babel. He is like the civic head. He's not a scholar. He's a civic head. In many times, he was also a Talmud Chacham, but it wasn't necessary for his position. He represented the Jewish community to the non-Jewish authorities. So Rabba Bar Ravuna is basically telling us a story we don't have his name. Rav Huna is simply telling of the Resh Galuta, and a certain thing happened. So he's reflecting on a certain thing in his life, which proves a given point, which we'll see in a minute. But the first thing we all have to understand is that by pre-scanning the Sugya and seeing whether the Amoraim, Sugya Chronolins, I'm able to determine what kind of sugya it is. And here I'm able to determine that it is an Amoraic sugya because they appear in chronological order. That tells me to do what? That tells me how to learn. How does it tell me how to learn? Who remembers? Who remembers what this tells me, that the Amoraim are presented in chronological sequence? That it is an Amoraic. What does that tell me? Anyone remember? That's right, Eitan. We learn the Memro first, and then the Gan. If we were to find that the Amoraim were not in chronological sequence, that would tell me that it is a Stamah Sugya, that the context is in the Stamah, and that we need to learn the Stamah Gemara in order, seeing the earlier statements as quotations, and not as the basic source material. So let's look at the sugya through the eyes of the Amoraim and see what we find. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Ein halakha, lo k'rid Yehuda, the machloket, in the machloket, whether or not you have to interrupt a meal once begun, if you begin a meal, let's say, at 8 hours of temporal daylight, and everyone agrees that there's nothing wrong with that. When it comes into the period in which it would be to interrupt that meal, or may you continue it until it gets dark? Rabbi Yehuda held that you have to interrupt it, and Rabbi Yossi held you don't have to interrupt it; you can continue eating. Now, in order to understand this machloket and the comment that we have here in component number one, we need to understand that to interrupt a meal in Meri Day meant not that you just stop eating. It means that you take the little tables that are in front of everyone away. Everyone ate from their own individual small tables, leaning on their left-hand side, on pillows, and they ate with their right hands. So when you interrupt a meal, it means that people sit up, take the tables away from them, and you finish the meal. You finish it either by Birkat Hamazon, or with the Mugmar, the incense they used to use, but you take the tables away. And when it says that you may continue eating, it means that you simply continue lying down on your left side, eating with your right hand, from the meal until it gets dark, and it's not a problem. Rav Yehuda is telling us here that the halacha is not like Rav Yehuda, and the halacha is not like Rav Yosef, but rather, Pores Mapa U'Mikadesh. that you simply put a cloth over the food. You don't have to uproot the table. You just put a cloth over the food, and you say Kiddush to recognize the sanctity of the day that's come upon you in the middle of your meal, then uncover your food and go at it again, and just keep on going, uproot the table. And take tables away. Did they all dine like kings with servants? Well, they didn't dine like kings, but they did have servants, and their servants were each other. There are many stories in the Gemara about Amoraim who served each other at meal times. Maybe they took turns. Maybe the younger Amoraim served the older Amoraim. I don't really know exactly. I suppose that's something that one could check. But they were servants who came and put the food on the tables for the people. And we're going to get to sugyas later on in this parak, where there are discussions about how do the servants behave in the eating of their meal, because they also have mitzvot achila on them to eat matzah and maror and korban pesach the same way that those who are reclining. And so Eitan is asking, just curious, if their families ate with them, and everyone ate lying down on their left hand side with little tables. I remember once on a few days before Pesach, several years ago, I recommended to my wife that we remove the large dining room table that we have for the room, and we put in little TV trays and pillows on the floor, and people can lie down and eat the way they did in the time of the Tanaim. So my wife suggested that she'd provide a little table for me in the other room, and everyone else would continue eating at the table. So I kind of gave up the idea. But that's the way they used to eat. Everyone used to lie down on their left-hand side and eat with their right hand on little tables. And that's, by the way, why there was a mitzvah of a seba, of leaning on your left-hand side, because that was the way that kings used to eat. Today, when we all sit sitting straight up around the table for the seba, and that it's not a requirement. And there's some poskim that have actually suggested that. But we'll get to this later on in later sugyas. In this sugya, in any event, Rav Yehuda, that we don't go according to Rav Yehuda or according to Rav Yosef, but we're poreis ma'pal mekadesh. We spread a cloth over our small table and we say kadesh. You hear as follows. On what authority does Rav Yehuda say against both shitot of the Tanaim? The machloket we had here was between Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda. These were the two Tanaim that were arguing here. How can an Amora come and say, well, we don't accept either Tanaitic opinion, and we do something else? On what authority can an Amora say that? Isn't it an accepted principle, my friends, that Amoraim do not disagree with Tanaim? How do you want to solve this problem? Again, your chat box, or press down on transmit and give me your opinion orally. How can an Amora disagree with all existing Tanaitic opinions? Anyone like to suggest something? So Yisrael is saying, maybe he's saying it on the authority of another Tana. And Jeff is saying, was there another opinion that supported it? That's okay. You must have another source, says Rav Achia. Okay, I want to, for all of you to take a look at the following. Who is it that Rav Yud is quoting? Shmuel. Eliyahu says there's a Tanya Nami Hachi at the end of the sugya. Very good. Very good, Eliyahu. But that doesn't help us here. That's a very clever remark, but that's not exactly what we're looking for here. What we're looking for here is that Rav Yehuda is saying this remark, and then, now, Shmuel was not only a first generation Amora. Shmuel, like Rav, was considered to be of similar authority of the last generation of the Tanaim. He's part of the swing generation. And since Shmuel says it, we have the concept of Rav Tana Upaleg. Rav has the status of a Tana and can argue. Shmuel has the same status. And therefore, even though if we were dealing with a later Amora, we would be behind a Tanaitic source for his opinion, a Braita of some sort that he can rely on, when we're quoting Shmuel, we don't need a Braita. Shmuel is the authority in and of himself, and he has the right to be Kolek on late Tanaim in the same way that Rav does. All right, now let's move on. So Rav Yudah says him on Shmuel's authority, Kores Mapa Umikadesh. And then we have a statement that Amar Rav Tachlifa Bar Vdimi Amar Shmuel, that Rav Tachlifa Bar Vdimi also is speaking in the name of Shmuel. Hishem Shekach Mafsikim LaHavdala. Now when Rav Tachlifa quotes Shmuel saying this, he uses the Tchkin. Which Tanit equals Mafsikim? This seems to imply that Shmuel holds according to whom? Like Rabbi Yehuda or like Rabbi Yosef? Who holds Mafsikim? Look back at the beginning of the, if you look at the end of Sugya number one, the Braita, who held Mafsikim? Yes, Rabbi Yehuda, that's correct. That's correct. Rabbi Yehuda held it. And therefore, since we have this statement in the name of Shmuel, Keshem Shemafsikim Lekidush, Kach Mafsikim Avdalah, it would appear that Shmuel is holding like Rabbi Yehuda. But this contradicts what he said in Kapon number one. That Halakha is not like Rabbi Yehuda or like Rabbi Yosef, but there, but Kores Mapa Umikadesh. So, and this is a problem, and the Amoraim do not resolve this problem. It remains a contradiction, an apparent contradiction. Well, and that's why in component number 2, Aleph 3, and 2 Bet, the Stamid de Gemara inserts itself into the Sugya and says that although Mafsikim, you might have thought that Mafsikim meant Akirat Shulchan, it might have meant the uprooting of the tables, the taking away of the tables, in which case Shmuel would be holding like Rabbi Yehuda, it's not really that. It's talking about when he's not using the way that we use it for Rabbi Yehuda, but we're using the term Mafsikim to mean that you use that you're Kores Mapa Umikadesh, uprooting of the table. Now Rav Achia is asking, was a contemporary of Rabbi Yehuda? Yes. Rav Tachlifa was a contemporary of Rav Yehuda, and he's a student of Shmuel as well. That is right. All right, so the end of component number 2, we have the opinion of Shmuel, which is not like Rav Yosef, and not like Rav Yehuda, but rather Kores Mapa Umekadesh. And now we come to the story of Rabba Bar Avuna in component number 3. Here, Rabba Bar Avuna tells us that he happened to get to the house of the Resh Galuta. He was invited to the house of the Resh Galuta. Either, he doesn't tell us whether it was on Erev Shabbat or Erev Chag, it's not clear. And we're told, Aitu Taka Kameh, they brought a table before him. He was sitting there having his meal, and it was Erev Shabbat or Erev Chag, we're not sure which. And it came time, and we all want to know, was he Mafsik? Like Rav Yehuda? Did he take away his table? Did he just continue eating like Rav Yosef? And the answer is no. Piras Mapa, Vikidesh, he spread a cloth over his table, and he said Kiddush. And this was according to the opinion that we learned from Shmuel in component number 1, that the halacha is not like Rav Yehuda, and not like Rabbi Yosef, but rather Kores Mapa Umekadesh. And at the end of the Sugya in Kabon number 4, the Stamid Gemara brings us a Braita. This is the Braita that Eliyahu mentioned earlier. Tanya Nami Hachi, She'en Levi'in Et HaShulchan, Ela In Kvi Kores Mapa Umekadesh. That you do not bring the table in front of the guest, a person who's going to eat a meal on Shabbat, unless he's first said Kiddush. But if they did already, if they brought the table in front of him, if he's lying down there on his left side with the table in front of him, and then if Tandis spreads a mapa, a cloth, over the table, and he says Kiddush. Now, this Baraita is a revolutionary Baraita, because it doesn't go according to Rabbi Yehuda, and it doesn't go according to Rabbi Yosef. It's an independent opinion, Kores Mapa Umekadesh. And this is the This Braita may have been the source, as Eliel Gerstel tried to say earlier, and I stopped him. It may actually have been the source for the Amoraim in Bavel, who said that this is a third Shita. Now, Eitan is asking, typically today, people don't start meals at these in-between times. Was it common times? Why did they not wait like we do today? Or alternatively, why don't we start our meals earlier today? Well, Eitan, your questions are excellent. You know that as time goes on, the halakha becomes more and more solidified and regulated, and there's less flexibility in our behavior because we are bound to the halakhic system in its development. And therefore, today it's no longer customary for us to begin a meal 10 minutes before Shabbat or a half hour before Shabbat, but rather we continue the practice that we've received from our ancestors, which is to wait and to eat the meal only after we say Kiddush on when the Shabbat or the Chag comes in. But we can see from these sugyot that this was not practiced in the time of the Amoraim, but some held that way, some held like Rav Yehuda, some they just continue eating, and the meal automatically becomes one of Shabbat Nitzah, and some held Poreis Mapal Mekadesh, that you spread a cloth over and say Kiddush. And from here, we're able to see the variety of opinions in those days and how our halacha came into being, because you see that the halacha, as we have at the end of Sugya number 2, is Poreis Mapal Mekadesh. When it became customary not to eat anymore on small tables, but rather to eat on one large table in European style, then there was no longer an issue of Akirat Shulchan and wait and to begin one's meal together with your family after Shabbat or Chag come in. Eitan is saying, I've heard people do that on Purim Erev Shabbat. They start early and go into Shabbat. Well, I don't know if that's due to their special state on Purim, or whether that's because they halakhically intend that, but the general custom when Purim comes out on Erev Shabbat is to have the Sudam of Sekhet early in the afternoon, so it's not to do that. But there are people, I imagine, that I know have actually suggested. In any event, my friends, what have we seen today? Our shiur is about to come to a close. But what we've seen here is by comparing the first sugya and the second sugya, we have seen two examples of Amoreik sugyot, where you learn either some of the Gemara as a later addition onto the sugya, either to explain or to further analyze that which is presented in the Amoreik statement. And by comparing the Amoreik statements, we can get a feeling of the way they looked at the statements of the Tanaim and what the relative authority of Amoraim was vis-a-vis the Tanaim. So with this, are there any final questions about what we did today, completing the first and learning the second sugya? If so, please ask now, either by audio or by chat.
Do we know the names of the Stama, who they were exactly?
No, we don't know the names of the Stama de Gemara. Rav Shvira Gaon, in his famous Igeret, gives us the names of a certain number of Savoraim, but we have no way of knowing whether these are the Savoraim that were responsible for the Stama de Gemara. Are there any other questions? Okay, it was nice to see everyone again, and I will see you again next Sunday in the same time, same station, on the E-Team Broadcasting Network, and I'm signing off from Charleston, South Carolina, and next week I will see you and broadcast from Eretz HaKodesh. If any of you have any questions, any of you need genealogical charts, or please write to me, and we'll be happy to provide them. And Shavua Tov, with the Sorot Tovot, Kulam. Bye-bye.